From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I started selling drugs when I was about 12. Started smoking weed when I was about 13. Started sniffing heroin when I was about 15. Maybe a little younger.
We have the Just Say No thing down, and we have the police chase down, but we have no clue what it is that, you know, a kid like DeAndre is supposed to say yes to.
With Election Day over, we go to one corner of one city neighborhood and examine one life. And the Justice Department says there's no evidence of civil rights violations in last year's police killing of a black youth in St. Petersburg. We'll get reaction. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. First, we'll take a look at the results of Tuesday's major races and ballot propositions around the country. We'll look at the two gubernatorial races in the nation. In New Jersey, incumbent Republican Christy Todd Whitman stayed in office with a razor-thin victory over Democratic State Senator Jim McGreevy. In Virginia, Republican Jim Gilmore, former Attorney General, easily defeated Democrat Don Beyer, the state's lieutenant governor. Gilmore succeeds Republican Governor George Allen, barred by law from seeking a second term. In the only congressional race in the country, this in New York's Staten Island, Republican City Councilmember Vito Fasella defeated conservative Democratic Assembly member Eric Vitaliano. Fasella succeeds Susan Molinari, who resigned to become a television anchorwoman. And there were a number of mayor's races around the country. In Boston, Democratic incumbent Thomas Menino, who was unopposed, won a second term. In Detroit, incumbent Dennis Archer won a second term. In Houston, former drug czar Lee Brown and businessman Rob Mosbacher will meet in a December runoff after neither won a majority. In Miami, incumbent Joe Carollo and ex-mayor Xavier Suarez will meet in a runoff on November 13th because neither won a majority. In Minneapolis, Democratic incumbent Sharon Sales Belton defeated independent Barbara Carlson, ex-wife of Governor Arn Carlson. In New York City, Republican incumbent Rudy Giuliani won with about a 10 percentage point lead over Democrat Ruth Messenger. And in St. Paul, Minnesota, incumbent Norm Coleman, who switched to the GOP last year, defeated Democratic State Senator Sandy Pappas. And now we'll take a look at some of the statewide propositions around the country. Ballot measures in the Pacific Northwest drew the most national attention this year as voters pondered social issues simmering in many corners of the country. Washington voters rejected a law requiring trigger locks on handguns and safety courses for owners. In Washington, one in five residents owns a handgun. The National Rifle Association and other gun advocacy groups outspent by 3-1 supporters of a proposition to require gun owners to pass an exam or take an 8-hour safety course to get licensed. Also, greater freedom was at issue in Washington's two health-related questions, also rejected, granting patients the right to keep their doctors if they switch jobs or health plans, and legalizing marijuana, heroin, and LSD for medicinal use. Both of those rejected. Also in Washington state, voters rejected a measure barring employment discrimination based on sexual orientation. Gay rights advocates, having watched for 20 years as Washington legislators repeatedly shot down anti-discrimination measures as special rights for homosexuals, made a key wording change this year. The measure proposed protection in the workplace or in union practices without requiring employee partner benefits or preferential treatment, but it was also rejected. Assisted suicide became legal in Oregon 3 years ago, but the law was immediately challenged in the courts and never put into effect. This year's proposal to repeal the law was overwhelmingly voted down. In Houston, the city stuck with an affirmative action plan that benefits women and minorities in city contracting and hiring. With 97% of the vote counted, a proposal to junk the program went down 54% to 46%. The fight over affirmative action in Houston became as much a battle of language as one of minority hiring when supporters of the practice succeeded in changing the ballot initiative's wording. A poll last month showed 69% would say yes if asked whether to dismantle programs that awarded jobs jobs on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin language straight from the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But the city council, which must approve all ballot questions, reworded the measure to ask instead if the city charter should be amended, quote, to end the use of affirmative action for women and minorities in employment and contracting, including ending the current program and any similar programs in the future. In Orange, California, an advisory vote on whether to support a school board's decision to drop bilingual education. Early returns had 86% of voters supporting the board. And in Maine, voters rejected granting voting rights to mentally ill people with guardians. New Yorkers have rejected calls for a constitutional convention to write a new state constitution to borrow $2.4 billion to build and renovate schools. And in rural southwestern Virginia, just 6 years after they voted to form the town of Castlewood, residents voted to dissolve it and refund themselves tens of thousands of dollars in local taxes and fees. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department closed its investigation this week into a police shooting that sparked back-to-back riots in St. Petersburg, saying there was no evidence the black victims' civil rights were violated. Tyron Lewis, who was 18 years old, was fatally shot by white officer James Knight during an October 24, 1996 traffic stop. Knight said he fired when the car lunged forward. The shooting sparked two nights of violence, one the night of the shooting, and another when a grand jury cleared Knight of criminal wrongdoing. Rioters burned businesses, hurled rocks and bottles at police officers. The probe by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Tampa, the FBI, and the Justice Department failed to uncover evidence to support a federal civil rights prosecution. This, according to the U.S. Attorney Charles Wilson in a statement on Monday. The investigation would have had to show that Knight acted willfully and knew he was using excessive force at the time of the shooting, the statement said. Also, that Knight also has been cleared of wrongdoing by the police department and reassigned to another area of the city. Since the riots, the police department was overhauled. The mayor worked up a long-term plan to improve the blighted conditions in poor neighborhoods where Lewis died. Millions of dollars in federal funds have been earmarked for business loans, education, and improved public housing. Joining us right now is the founder of the Uhuru Movement, which is Swahili for freedom. He's chair of the African People's Socialist Party. His name is Omali Eshetela. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, why don't you tell us what your reaction is to this ruling? We spoke to you, Omali, earlier this year when the riots took place and when Tyron Lewis, who was 18 years old, was fatally shot by James Knight.
Well, we're not surprised by the ruling. The ruling by the Justice Department is consistent with everything that's happened up to now by any level of government regarding the killing of Tyron Lewis and the treatment of the African community by the police department. When Lewis was killed on October 24th, James Knight said that he killed Lewis in defense of his life. He said that Tyron Lewis had over and over again attempted to use a car to run him down, that in fact he had been hit 9 times by the car and the last time hit so hard that he was thrown up against near the windshield of the car and was forced to fire in self-defense. Subsequent to that time, in fact, within the last 2 weeks, the St. Petersburg Times ran an article with that talked about the physical evidence that the grand jury had, the grand jury that exonerated Knight for killing Tyron Lewis on November 13th. And it becomes very clear, looking at that evidence, that there is no way that Knight thought his life was in danger, and therefore it makes quite irrational the Justice Department determination that he did not know he was using excessive force. If I might give example, the police department, we've learned, took pictures of Knight's legs immediately after the shooting. There was no evidence that he had been struck by a car at all. The The report also revealed that the medical examiner determined that that Knight had been shot in his left arm as he was turning to unlock the door of the car, while his left arm was raised. And upon being shot in his right arm, he immediately lost the use of it. So we had one arm that was up, the other hand turning to open the door. There's no way that he could have been steering the car to try and hit Knight. And if this is the case, then clearly Knight knew that he was using excessive force because he was simply involved in a traffic stop. Beyond that, the police department had taken fingerprints from the hood of the car. There were no fingerprints on the hood of the car where Knight said he had been thrown by the violence of the car hitting him, and the only fingerprints of his fingerprints were on the front of the hood near the grill. So the physical evidence corroborated, in fact, what more than 40 witnesses to a grand jury had already said, that Knight was never in danger when he killed Teron Lewis. And I don't understand the logic, then, if he was never in danger, why they can say that he didn't know he was using excessive force when he killed Teron Lewis.
Again, we're talking to Amalia Shetela, who is a founder of the Uhuru Movement, chair of the African People's Socialist Party. Well, let's talk about the reaction after the killing of Teron Lewis, the sparking of two nights of violence, both the night of the shooting and when the grand jury cleared Knight, and what you felt was wrong with the police reaction, and where the police department in St. Petersburg is today.
Well, first of all, there were two nights of rebellion. On October 24th, that was the first day, and that was immediately following, shortly thereafter, the assassination of Teron Lewis by the St. Petersburg Police Department. It was a just rebellion. It was a just response by coming from the most oppressed sector of this community, a community that has long learned that there cannot be any kind of justice, and that was just confirmed by the Justice Department determination coming from the establishment. And so the people rose up when this killing occurred, and the response immediately of the police department was never to suggest that there was anything wrong or the police could have possibly violated the rights of Teron Lewis when they killed him. Their immediate response here, just as it is throughout the country, was to slander the victim. So immediately we saw pick mug shots of 18-year-old Teron Lewis from his involvement with the criminal justice system. The government and the local media attacked the Uhuru Movement as being responsible for the rebellion, as though it were we who had killed Teron Lewis in the streets of St. Petersburg. On November 13th, I want to clarify that because it is often reported in this area that the rebellion on November 13th was sparked by a grand jury verdict. That is incorrect. What happened on November 13th is the St. Petersburg Police Department, in an apparent attempt to provoke a situation that would allow them to crush the Uhuru Movement that had been the most critical force in the community of the police subsequent to the killing of Teron Lewis, they came to our center first, 27-strong SWAT team, to arrest somebody, they said, because he had an expired license plate. They handcuffed this person. They pepper sprayed me, another member of our movement. Even as hundreds of people from the community had begun to gather because of the police activity. And it was later that day that the rebellion occurred, when the police, more than 300 strong, using state, county, and various local police organizations, used all the tear gas they had in the city of St. Petersburg against our building, where babies, other children, women, and men were trapped. And it was in response to this attack on our community, that on the center and the attempt to crush our movement, that the community rose up and fought the police off and saved the lives of the people who were in that building. Since that time, we've had another typical response by the city, and in the sense that they have elevated an African who was an officer on the police department to make him chief of police after having moved the chief of the police, made him the chief administrator of the city of St. Petersburg. So who is the person overall responsible for the police anyway? So we still have the same objective relationship. We had an African who was assistant chief of police under the guy who is now the chief administrator. Now he is the chief of police under the guy who is now chief administrator. So that rather transparent attempt to calm the community down by giving the appearance of empowering the African community through hiring a black police chief has been one of the most recent responses to the clear differences, the dissatisfaction that exists in this community to the killing of Teron Lewis.
Amalia Shetela, at the end of the news item I read about the response to the riots and the killing, the news piece I had said millions of dollars in federal funds have been earmarked for business loans, education, improved public housing. Is that true?
There's some truth to that. In fact, what has occurred, because the police and the local authorities here they fail in their attempts first to criminalize and then to destroy our movement, they have found it absolutely necessary to begin a process of negotiation and discussions with our movement, which was extremely important because up to now, they had attempted to simply characterize the African community here as criminal, inarticulate, and pathological, therefore making it unnecessary to respond to any needs of the people. And our organization that spoke for the most oppressed sector of the community, they could also easily dismiss as being some extremist marginal force. But since the people thrust themselves into political life, and since there's also a move in this city at this juncture, bringing a baseball team that begins playing next year, and much of the economy being organized around that baseball team with a dome for the team put right in the middle of the black community, they need an environment. They need an investment-friendly environment, and they need to try and pacify this community, and so they found it necessary to enter into discussions with us, and because of that, we have raised serious demands about genuine economic development to this community.
You mean baseball is good for America?
That's if it's good for for St. Petersburg, I guess it's good for America. But because of that, that the crises that they have, the problem that they need to solve, the community has had some leverage in making demands of some genuine economic development for the community, as opposed to the traditional deals that they like to make behind closed doors with specific individuals that would allow them photo opportunities to say, look what we've done for the community. So there appears to be some movement now in making some economic development happen in this community because of the convergence of these circumstances that we just mentioned.
I also remember quite vividly when you came on after the second night of the rebellion describing what had happened, the coalition that had formed along with the African People's Socialist Party, really a cross-section of St. Petersburg society.
This coalition has proved, in my view, to be the most important occurrence in this city, not only recently, but in my lifetime. It has unified the community in a fashion that's made it very difficult for the city authorities to do the traditional thing of getting one or more Africans and giving them something at the expense of the community, using them against the community. We have a magnificent coalition that is broad-based, that is extremely diverse, and that includes in a very prominent place African working people and poor people in their organization in the form of the Uhuru Movement. That is one of the key things that I think that's made it necessary for the city to actually attempt some movement toward actual, genuine economic development.
Amalia Ashitello, we do have to go, but could you give us the phone number, how people could reach the African People's Socialist Party in St. Petersburg?
People could call us at area code 813-821-6620.
That's 813-821-6620. Again, the decision by the Justice Department that the police shooting that sparked back-to-back riots in St. Petersburg, there's no evidence that the black victim's civil rights were violated. Teron Lewis's 18 years old, fatally shot by a white police officer. That came out of the civil rights decision, the civil rights division of the Justice Department. And the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Orrin Hatch, is now saying he'll vote against the nomination of Bill Lan Lee to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, throwing into serious question Lee's effort to become the first Asian American to serve as the government's top civil rights enforcer. So that decision has come down without a permanent head of the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Election Day is over, and politicians will now go on vacations after stumping around their cities, their areas, on many issues, one of them the issue of drugs and crime. And so today we thought we would sit back and have a conversation with one person who lives in one corner of one city neighborhood in this country. His name is DeAndre McCullough. And his story is written about in a new book by David Simon and Edward Burns called The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood. Before we go to DeAndre, let's turn to David Simon. David, tell us a little about your book, The Corner.
In a way, I think it's about the logical consequence and, in some sense, the end game for the drug war. Baltimore is one of the cities with the highest rate of intravenous drug use in the nation. So it's the place that has sort of landed at one end of the extreme in terms of the drug war. And we wanted to go to a place where that war was being fought and look at it from the point of view of the people being policed rather than from the point of view of the law enforcement community, which is vested. And we chose Fayette and Monroe Streets in West Baltimore. And one of the first people we encountered was DeAndre.
What was that first meeting like, DeAndre?
Oh, man.
How'd you meet David?
Well, they just showed up in our neighborhood, and for like two white guys to show up in our neighborhood without wanting any drugs or trying to lock us up, it was kind of strange. But after being around them for a while, I came to realize they was good people, so we're still friends.
Tell them about what your mother thought at first.
My mother thought they was police. She told me to stay the hell away from them. I mean, a lot of people didn't trust them for a while, but people got used to them, seeing they wasn't trying to go anywhere, so people just learned to accept that they wasn't going away and just took to them.
What were you doing there, especially that corner? What is the significance of that corner?
Well, that's the neighborhood I was born and raised in. I mean, I did everything there, a lot of things I'm not proud of, but it was part of growing up for me. I mean, for me, the book was about a lot of changes that I was going through in my life. I mean, the drugs, I mean, the violence, a lot of things. But it was a learning experience, and I'm trying to leave that behind now.
How old are you?
20.
20. Well, David, you said we wanted to go somewhere to do this, but why?
Well, with the first book, which was Homicide, I was doing an ethnography covering the interior lives of police, following a squad of detectives. And that's one half of the story. But I think in terms of the drug war, there's something that's gone awry with the nature of the thing. I think it began as a war quite nobly against drugs. I think it's effectively become a war against the underclass. It's not the intent, but I think that's what's resulted. In Baltimore, you have 19,000 arrests a year on the average for drug-related crimes. For the whole state of Maryland, you have maybe 22,000 prison cells for all crimes, for all jurisdictions, Baltimore being one of about 24 jurisdictions. So there's no place to put these arrests, and what you're effectively created is a sort of meaningless stat game. We're spending a lot of money. We're accomplishing nothing. We're not serving the interests of those neighborhoods in any way.
You say that you started by doing your book Homicide following police. So what was it like to go from one side to the other?
It was strange at times. I can remember one particularly awkward moment when there was a shooting in the neighborhood, and I was on the other side of the yellow tape watching with everybody else, and a detective that I knew from the first book made a point of sort of singling me out and having an amiable chat, which required all kinds of explanation for the next day or two to people who had seen that occur. I think most of the police that knew me from the first book were smart enough just to ride by and not throw anything out to me that got me in trouble on the corner. But it was strange.
Because they knew what you were doing.
Yeah, I think word got around after a couple months that the second book was about a drug corner and not to bother Dave when he's out there.
DeAndre, what was your relationship with the police over the years?
My relationship with the Baltimore City Police Department, I mean, I think that my relationship was the same as any other kid my age in any ghetto in America. I mean, I couldn't stand them. I mean, I didn't want to be their friend. They didn't want to be mine.
What was your first encounter with the police?
My first encounter with the police, I would say I was about 10 years old, and I got caught throwing rocks at a train. Police took me home. My mother seen the police escort me through the door, and she gave me a beating that I still remember. And ever since then, I never liked the police.
What about on that corner?
On the corner, I mean, every day. I mean, running into the police was an everyday event. Every day they harassed us. Every day we said to hell with them. They wasn't going away, we wasn't going away. I mean, neither one of our situations was getting any better.
What about your involvement with drugs? How did that start?
I started selling drugs when I was about 12. Started smoking weed when I was about 13. Started sniffing heroin when I was about 15. Maybe a little younger. And now I'm trying to leave that behind me, too.
Was any of those steps a major decision, or did you sort of just fall into it?
Well, I mean,
like selling?
Well, no one forces you to do anything. I mean, if you want to do something, you're going to do it. But no one tried to encourage me not to do it either, so it wasn't a hard decision. I mean, I was going through a lot of pain in my life, and getting high was my way of relief. Getting high was my way of saying to hell with everything. But as soon as your high wore off, the pain was still there, so you get high again. And it never solved anything, but it made me feel better.
What was the pain?
I mean, everything that was going on around me. I was in a house that I didn't want to live in. I mean, I had people running in and out my house all day, using, selling. My parents were getting high. I was living in a neighborhood where as though if you didn't get high or you didn't sell drugs, you didn't fit in. So, I mean, the choices to do something right, I mean, it wasn't many, so like so many other people, I got caught up.
So how did you come out of it?
I'm still not out of it, because for the rest of my life, I'm always be a dope fiend. All I can do is say I'm not going to get high today. I can't tell you what I'm going to do tomorrow. I'm just living day by day now.
How long have you been drug-free?
For about a month and a half.
What keeps you determined to do it, at least today? Why did you wake up and say you wouldn't do it today?
Because I feel as though if I start going hard, running the streets again, something's going to happen to me. I know something's going to happen to me, because with these kids these days, either you're going to have to kill one of them, or one of them going to kill one of you. I mean, nowadays, if a kid smack you, you're thinking, should I hit this kid back? Because if you do, he might kill you. Therefore, you ain't taking no chances. You're just killing him first, and I'm not trying to be a part of that, so I just stay home and mind my business. I mean, I ain't got that much clean time as far as drug-free time under my belt, but I haven't been running the streets for a while now. I mean, when I was getting high recently, I mean, it was like maintenance use. I wasn't out there running hard, selling drugs, and doing all of the things that I was doing. It was a getting high because I was bored type thing. But that's not even right either, but the streets is not for me no more. It's a kid's game. I mean,
your last run was with Sweet Pea, right? Was that the last run?
Yeah.
That was about 6 months ago.
And who's Sweet Pea?
A neighborhood drug dealer who was killed about 6 months ago.
How was he killed?
Got you out of a debt.
Oh, yeah. I had owed him some money, right? And I was, like, worrying about it. And he was killed. I'm not happy that he died, but I guess he won't want his money now.
How was he killed?
He was shot down.
On the street?
Yeah.
Of the kids that we were, of DeAndre and his crew, the kids that we followed that year, two are dead. DeAndre's cousin, Dinky, was shot to death. Boo was shot to death. Two others, Tay and RC, were wounded on that same corner, but RC's doing well now. He's got a job now. I think Tay's still struggling. Brian came back. Brian was locked up here on Rikers, right?
Yeah.
He came back recently.
He's back out there. I would say out of everybody who I grew up with since as far back as I can remember, I would say about a handful, about 3 to 5, are doing what they supposed to be doing. Everybody else is dead or getting high. I mean, selling drugs used to be fun. It was a time where you sold drugs. I mean, you go to the strip bars, you buy your little stripper, take out the hotel, handle your business. You go smoke some weed, you go get drunk, go rent a car. I mean, it was fun for a while, but now people getting high to support their habit. And it's a place in Baltimore, Monroe and Fed, where they sell $3 vials of coke. If you're selling $3 vials of coke and it costs you $10 to get high, how do you make money? You don't. I mean, kids that I grew up with now, they basically just getting high to support their habit.
We're talking to DeAndre McCullough and David Simon. David Simon and Edward Burns wrote a book called The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood, talking about DeAndre's corner. Did the presence of David and Edward change your life? I mean, is that part of why you're trying to get out of it, or do you think that would have happened anyway?
No, that has nothing to do with it, because if I want to do something, I'm going to do it. And the influence of another individual, I mean, they do their thing, I do mine. When I first met them, it didn't stop me from selling drugs. It didn't stop me from getting high. It didn't stop me from carrying firearms or any other things I was doing before I met them. But I tried to keep it out of their presence. But as you see in the book, they found out anyway. But,
David, I mean, how did you find out?
Well, the corner is a kind of insulated place. It's really sort of a watering hole for the whole neighborhood. And what one person doesn't tell you, five others will. And one of the things that I found from doing this kind of journalism, to sort of stand around and watch journalism, is that the longer you go with your subjects, the more truth comes out. If we'd have written this book after following DeAndre and Gary and Fran and the other characters in the book for 6 months, a certain amount of deception would have passed muster. I mean, things that we thought after 6 months we learned the exact opposite were in fact true. Maybe a year later, a year and a half later, we've been, when we met DeAndre, it was 15. And I think you were onto something before when you talked about it being sort of the absence of a decision. It's not really, in that environment, you know, DeAndre's growing up in a shooting gallery. Both his parents were deeply involved in drugs at the time, although his mother is now doing very well. But at the time, it's the absence of a decision, the absence of believing in any kind of tomorrow. And that's where sort of the drug war's gone wrong, is that we have the just say no thing down, and we have the police chase down, but we have no clue what it is that, you know, a kid like DeAndre is supposed to say yes to in that neighborhood. It wasn't that he decided to sell drugs or he decided to get high. He just, the moment never came where he decided not to sell drugs. And I don't think we've developed a weapon system against that kind of thinking yet in the drug war.
DeAndre, what about your parents?
Well, my father, he passed away last year. My mother, she has a couple years clean under her belt. I mean, I'm proud of her. She's my all. She's my best friend. Sometimes we disagree on a lot of things, but, I mean, she's my mother, so sometimes I find myself humbling myself. But, my father, he died of a drug overdose after he had a couple months. He had, like, 3 months clean. Mm-hmm. He had 3 months clean. He came home. He haven't even been home for 2 days. And his brother, my uncle, I'm not saying that my father's not old enough to make his own decisions, but turned him out again, started him using again, his first blast, I guess.
Back from where?
Say again?
He was back from where?
He was back from out of a treatment center. But my mother, she's doing very well. I'm proud of her. She was a drug counselor, but they stopped funding, and now she's transporting disabled patients to the hospital.
How did your mother get involved with drugs to begin with?
I mean, my mother been getting high for 28 years. I mean, I wasn't there. I mean, from my understanding, back then, getting high was fun. I mean, people getting high now to hide their pain, but it was a time where you could get high, have fun, and still go to work and maintain and handle your business, but now people just sit around and get high all day. From what she was telling me, they still did that thing, but they also had a time for it. And now the time for it is all the time, so time's changed.
I think the difference there is coke and dope. Heroin was much more of a maintenance drug than cocaine can be. Two different pharmacological effects, and I think one of the things that we're finding with cocaine, I think, became pretty clear in by the late 80s in Baltimore, and I'm sure up here as well, is that while you could get by on $20 or $30 a day and maintain a heroin habit, coke would just go right through your pockets. I mean, any money you had was going right up to the corner, so that it became much more of a chase for people using, particularly since in Baltimore, most of the people who started out just on straight heroin ended up shooting speedballs of most of the intravenous users anyway. So the climate of the drug corner has actually changed in the last 5-6 years.
What about crack?
Oh, man. Whoever invented crack, I mean, he should burn in hell. I mean, that's a drug that, it's a form of coke, but its potency is like triple. I mean, crack'll have you stealing from your mother, selling your kids clothes. I mean, it'll have you doing some things that you definitely wouldn't normally do. I mean, I think it's the most addictive drug out there. It's insanity.
Did you use much crack?
I always said that I would never do it. I did it one time. And when I did it, I had just read up. I had just went and bought me a half ounce of crack. I took one hit. I stayed in the house for 3 days. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. All I did was smoke. And when I came down off that high, I felt 14 carats stupid. For one, I just smoked $1,100. For two, I was broke. And for three, I was embarrassed because I always said that I would never do it.
Why the distinction? Why did you say, I'd do this and this, but I wouldn't do this?
because I think it's like it's different. It's different levels of being. I mean, it's worse. Some people think that it's worse to shoot dope than to sniff dope. Some people think that coke is the mother of all drugs, and that's definitely a no-no. I mean, it's to each his own. I mean, if it's smoking a joint, getting high is getting high. I mean, drugs are drugs, but people's distinction and how they look at them is different.
Fayette and Monroe, that's the corner in West Baltimore that we're talking about, where the full price of the drug culture is being paid. You're listening to DeAndre McCullough, who lives on that corner, and David Simon, who's the author of the book The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood. He wrote it with Edward Burns. We're going to come back to this conversation in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about life on a corner in West Baltimore, inner city neighborhood, and we're talking about an extraordinary book, The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood, that tells the searing true story of 1 year in the life of this place. It's written by David Simon and Edward Burns, and one of the people it focuses on is DeAndre McCullough. David, DeAndre was just talking about drugs and distinctions between them, who uses, who sells. Go on with that conversation.
By way of comparison, that summer, the summer of the year we spent in the neighborhood, DeAndre's father, Gary, had a heroin habit, even had a speedball problem, but he managed to work every day of the summer at a crab house, worked hard, he was in fact their hardest worker, and maintain his addiction as well as being effectively a taxpayer. I mean, well, he wasn't paying taxes, but he was making legitimate money. Anybody who's on the pipe, they're not going to be able to hold down a job like that if they're hardcore on the pipe.
Who was providing the crack? Who was providing the dope and the coke?
What do you mean?
I mean, who was selling? Were they different, or was the same person selling everything, and was that you?
It depends. I mean, who I got my stuff from? It depends on who had the best product at that time. I mean, you ain't going to get garbage if you know someone's selling garbage. Of course, you're not going to buy it from them. But my connects varied. I mean, I had no particular person that I would cop from. I mean,
How many were New Yorkers of the people down there?
Well, the New York thing done really changed. I mean, like back when I was a little younger, when I first started hustling, that's all I was really working for was New York boys. I mean, it was a lot of New York to Baltimore traffic down there then. But now these kids in Baltimore, with the games that they're playing, they plan you stay home. I mean, they don't like people from out of town coming down there selling drugs. And I've watched a lot of people from out of town get killed just because they were from out of town, because not because they got better product or nothing like that, but just a jealousy thing. I mean, these kids, they ready to die for a corner that don't even belong to them. That's just how it is now. But that's like when anywhere you go. I mean, if you put your hours in on a block and you making money out there, you're not gonna see nobody, especially if you're not from that town, come there and take your money. I mean, that's cutting your throat.
I wanted to go back to your mother because, well, obviously what you say, she's your best friend. She had tremendous influence and continues to have tremendous influence on you. But the whole issue of her using drugs through your life. When you were growing up, even before you got involved with drugs, what was that like in your house? I mean, was just drugs a main part of your house?
Well, from as far back as I can remember, I mean, my mother always got high. And I didn't really understand to like how severe the problem was until I got older and realized what drugs were. I mean, I would always say a sniff or, you know what I'm saying, something like that, but I never knew what it was. I knew what it was, but I didn't know that it was so bad to be doing. So I started getting older and my friends started talking about it and people started commenting on it and things like that, but she's still your mother. I mean, it's still a certain amount of respect that you have to have for her, no matter what she does.
Was there any sense in the house that you shouldn't do this, or was this just something you were going to grow into?
My mother never put vials in my hand and sent me out on a corner. She always did her best to, like, try to keep me away from that. But, I mean, once you're 12 or 13 years old, you and your mother the same size, the ass whipping stopped. I mean, my father wasn't there. I'm basically the man now. I mean, once you outgrow those ass whippings, you do what you want to do. The beating stop hurting. I mean, I remember the last time my mother hit me, I was watching the Soul Train. And this girl came on it, and I said, damn. She said, what you say? And she picked up a broom, and she smacked me in my head with it, and it broke. And I looked at her and laughed. And she had this look on her face like I scared her. And it made me feel good because she never hit me again. And after that, I just did what I wanted to do. I mean, my mother went so far as to call the police on me. I've been in the bathroom sitting on the toilet, valing up, and the police come knocking on the door. I mean, things like that. She never encouraged me, but at the same time, she couldn't stop me.
She called the police because she knew you were using.
She called the police. I wasn't using that. She called the police because I was selling a product and wouldn't give her none. That's what it basically boiled down to. It had nothing to do with me, her worrying about me at that time. She just knew that I had a bomb and she wanted to hit.
This was on Lorraine Avenue?
No, this was on Fair Street. But, I mean, that's some of the things I went through.
We're talking to David Simon, who is co-author of the book The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood, and one of the people he focuses on in his book on a West Baltimore neighborhood, specifically a corner, is DeAndre McCullough, and that's who you're listening to right now. What about jail? Did you go to jail?
Fortunately, I've never spent as much time there as I should have spent. And I can say that now because it's behind me. But I've been lucky with the system. I mean, I got so many charges, it's ridiculous. And the most time I spent in the juvenile system was, what, like 8 days, something like that?
Boys Village, yeah.
Adult system, about the same amount. But
how'd you stay out?
Luck. It had nothing to do with how street smart I was. It had nothing to do with who I knew. It was just luck. Because I got friends who only been locked up 2-3 times. Every time they been locked up, they did a year better. I just been fortunate. I mean, my mother always told me I had a horseshoe in my back pocket. But I just been lucky, that's all.
Do you think jail would have been good for you?
I mean, it couldn't have been no worse than what I was already going through. I mean, you would get more respect for coming out of jail than finishing school. So if I was to go to jail, I would come home. I would be broke, someone would give me a package, and I would start all over. Whereas though if I finished school, everyone would, you think you shit, you think you so smart. I mean, that's the attitude that's out there. I mean, people don't respect you for doing things that's right. I mean, they look at me different now, and I'm not even doing half the things that I want to do. I mean, I go down the way now, I forget where I came from. I ain't gone nowhere. I mean, I'm in a county, but I'm not that far away. I mean, I just changed my address. I ain't forget where I came from, because I can always go back.
Yeah. DeAndre's friend in the book, R.C., I think he'd been out of the neighborhood about 6 months. He was working a good job as a forklift operator. He was living with a girl that he was engaged to. Everything was going great for him. And then Boo got killed, and he came back to the neighborhood to hear about what was up with Boo. And he got a load of grief from Tay and from the other kids in the crew about having forgotten where he came from and having been out of the neighborhood. So he missed a day of work to hang around. Then he missed another day. Then he started getting high. Then he was out on the corner. A couple days later, he got shot, just wounded. But, lost the job, lost the girl, went to jail. He's doing well now, but there is that pressure to, not to make a move, the absence of a decision again. And I guess with the book, our reason for writing the book is that all the law enforcement in the world can't come to terms with that. We can't reach that portion of the people down on Fayette Street that is valid, that gets validation from the fact that they're getting high or selling drugs. I mean, when there's nothing else in this neighborhood, there's no other viable economic system, the corner not only becomes a marketplace, which is what it began as, but it becomes something more than that. It solves everybody's, for lack of a better word, existential crisis. I mean, when you're getting high, you know every morning what it is you're supposed to do, not only with that day, but seemingly with the rest of your life. When you're selling drugs, you know what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to vial up and get down there for the shift change, and when the police aren't there, make your money. And for people that aren't getting any other validation, they're totally disconnected from the rest of from the country. They've manufactured their own reason for being and meaning. And the fact that it's destructive, that it's gonna tear down themselves in the neighborhood, that's almost secondary to the fact that they don't have to wake up and wonder what the heck it is that they're supposed to do. And nothing that we've constructed, no weapon system in the war on drugs has gotten even close to dealing with that yet.
DeAndre McCullough, what do you think would work?
Well, I mean, if you're going to go into a neighborhood where drugs is running the neighborhood and you want to take that away from them, I mean, what are you going to offer them? For some, I mean, the drug market meant money. If that meant money to them, you're going to offer them jobs. Getting high makes you feel good. What are you going to put in their life to make them feel good instead of clouding their mind? You can't take something away without offering anything in return. I mean, that's not fair. I mean, it doesn't sound right, but it's not fair. I mean, these people are used to doing this their whole life. I mean, selling drugs, getting high is their way of life. If you want to take that from them, you're going to have to offer them something in return.
What about school? What role did school play in your life?
I don't even remember school. I mean, when I went to school, last time I went to school was, I think, 95, 94, something like that. I was in the ninth grade for 3 years. I was so high, I don't even remember. I remember going there. I remember the first day because, of course, you're throwing the new clothes and everything. But after the first week, I mean, it's like cloudy. I remember being in the principal's office. I was like in one of the, I know I was like in the only school in Baltimore where you didn't get in trouble for smoking weed. I mean, I used to sit in the hallway, smoke weed. Every day was my same routine. I go to school, get high, go to class, be made to stand in the hallway for 10 or 15 minutes to air out. Go to sleep in class, I mean, next period.
But then you would give teachers an occasional glimpse of just how smart you were and what you could do.
Yeah, when I wasn't high.
Every now and then.
Like what?
Well, there was the moment when he raised his hand. This is in the book. He raised his hand to become the orator for the class. There was a citywide oration contest for public speaking, and the kid who was supposed to do it didn't show up that day. And from back of the class, probably in a marijuana haze, I'm not sure, but DeAndre's hand went up. I think everybody else in the class was stunned. It was the first active class participation in half a year. He raised his hand, he walked to the front of the class, and he did the I Have a Dream speech from the March on Washington, Martin Luther King. Did it well enough that the teacher wanted him to do it citywide. And I think despite a few attempts to get out of it, he showed up, and he did really well. He did really extremely well. And then, having done this, having had this epic moment, he disappeared below the waves for the rest of the school year. But leaving that English teacher, I think, was something to think about of the mind that was locked inside. That was, you know, it was just hell getting it out.
Do you remember that, DeAndre?
Yeah, so I remember that. I remember the tight pink shirt with my stomach hanging out. I remember the high water khakis, and I remember sitting up there on the stage with the two finest girls I had seen that
the other
day,
contestants.
Who had my attention, who I could not stop staring. I mean, how could you beat someone who you was in love with?
How'd you know you were in love with her?
I just knew I was in love with her, but I remembered it was pretty fun.
That's about
fun.
15 times a day he falls in love.
Yeah, I fall in love.
20 times a day here in New York.
I fall in love a lot in New York. I love this city. I love it.
What in school would have reached you? Was there anyone that tried?
I think a drug counselor would have reached me, who knew, who understood my problem, instead of a drug counselor who has book knowledge without hands-on experience. I mean, I needed a drug counselor more than a teacher back then. I mean, I was lost. I was out there. I couldn't have been reached because I didn't want to be reached by anyone. I mean, if anyone would have reached me, it would have been my mother, because for one, she understood my problem. For two, she had the same problem. But I was just a man back then.
The power of the corner is such that you see kids being lost to it earlier. I mean, in that neighborhood, by 7 and 8 and 8 and 9, you start seeing kids, the younger kids at the rec center, we could see them start to be around the fringe of the game and to learn. And you learn a way of thinking that'll do well for you on the corner, but it's not going to help you at all in the external world. Things like turning the other cheek or letting something go by is, or allowing yourself to be humbled by a boss. That's stuff we all got to learn in the external world. You know, you're at McDonald's, boss humbles you, you got to deal with it. On the corner, being humbled is going to get you hurt. So that all the skills that you learn and that DeAndre was learning, I mean, by the time we found him when he was 15, he was, nominally he was a half foot in school and a half foot on the corner, but he was really, the corner rules had been pretty much ingrained in him. And those are things that it's very hard to shed. And the even scarier thing is that even people who don't grow up in the corner culture, for example, DeAndre's father, Gary, got out. In every fundamental way, working two jobs, learned to invest his money by reading the Daily Investor every day, built up a brokerage account to about $150,000. He showed me the old statements. I was stunned. I mean, a very bright man who had pretty much fashioned his future. 1 year of college, he was a supervisor at Beth Steele. Yet when cocaine hit, he elected to stay in the neighborhood rather than move to the suburbs. There was a moment when they actually looked at a house. And they didn't. They stayed on Fayette Street, and cocaine hit, and the neighborhood just collapsed. And you hang around long enough, it drags you down. Gary ended his life completely in the corner van.
David Simon, I want to continue this conversation tomorrow with you and DeAndre McCullough, and also find out about DeAndre, the fact that you're a father and what that means to you, and find out about the girls and women in your life and the effects that they've had on you, in addition to your mother. Yes, DeAndre McCullough is the subject of David Simon and Edward Burns' book, The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood, that neighborhood in West Baltimore, The Corner, Fayette and Monroe, a forgotten intersection. The American dream has crumbled to a nightmare there, but there's also a story of hope, caring, and love on that corner, and we'll find out more about that. Tomorrow, also on Democracy Now!, we're going to take on the issue of fast-track authority. Will President Clinton get the vote he wants on Friday when the big vote comes down in Congress, the right to pass, to approve trade legislation that Congress will not be able to amend? If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230, and you can order a cassette copy. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Leslie George is our director. Errol Maitland, our engineer. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Special thanks to Janice K. Bryant and Zachary Fink. Our email address, if you'd like to reach us, is democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!